This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Jolin, and I'm your host for this episode. I'm here with Dr. Roberto Gonzalez to discuss his new book, War Virtually, The Quest to Automate Conflict, Militarize Data, and Predict the Future, published by University of California Press in April 2022. The book presents a critical look at how the U.S. military is weaponizing technology and data for new kinds of warfare and why we must resist. Dr. Gonzalez is professor and chair of the San Jose State University Anthropology Department. He has authored four books, including Connected, How a Mexican Village Built Its Own Cell Phone Network, and Militarizing Culture, Essays on the Warfare State. Thank you so much, Roberto, for joining me to discuss your book. It was a pleasure to read.
Thank you for the introduction and for the invitation to be here with you today.
Now, normally at the beginning of an episode, I might ask you to tell us a bit about your background, but in fact, you already introduced yourself to our NBN listeners when you were on the podcast back in October of 2021. To discuss your book, Connected. Can you remind us briefly where your educational journey has taken you and what links might exist between your Connected book project and your research for War Virtually?
Sure, I'd be glad to do that. I began my college career not even knowing what anthropology was. I started out as a mechanical engineering major. As a high school student, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and mechanical engineering sounded as good as any other major, and I heard it was a good career path. And I studied that for 4 years, and even worked as a student engineer in a couple of places, including a General Motors assembly plant, of all things. And then my senior year, my fifth year, I should say, I took a general ed course that was the Introduction to Cultural Anthropology course at the University of Texas at Austin. And I was blown away. My mind was, my world was turned upside down, as they say. And I very quickly investigated how long it would take me to get a degree in anthropology. And I found out I could probably do it in about three semesters. And I just took the plunge, much to my parents' dismay. But I have no regrets at all about doing it. I applied to PhD programs during my second to last semester, and surprisingly got accepted at a number of places, including UC Berkeley. So I was a fairly late arrival to the field of anthropology, but I discovered very quickly that it was a much better fit for who I am as a scholar and as a writer, and gave me a kind of insight into the way that humans behave the way they do. Now, after being an anthropologist now for 25 years, I've had time to reflect on my different research topics and research interests. And I would say that the connecting thread is that there is some element of looking at science and technology within a cultural framework that links all of my work from beginning to end. And so just to give an example, my doctoral dissertation was a project called Zapotec Science that was looking at the work of peasant farmers in southern Mexico in a remote mountain village with real careful attention to how they operate using essentially a version of the scientific method, but using their own cultural assumptions along the way. And then later on, you've mentioned my book Connected, which came out in 2020. That's a book about the same village, but it's the story of how they built their own community-based cell phone network against all odds, without any help from the government or multinational telecom companies. And so there's a very heavy element of science and technology studies throughout that book. And then, of course, most recently, the book that we're talking about here today, War Virtually, is all about the world of scientists, engineers, computer programmers, data analysts, and trying to get a better understanding of the cultural assumptions that they make as they go about their work, and also a critical analysis of the dangers that these technologies might pose for us over the long term.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. I wanted to just draw a point of comparison actually between your trajectory and my own. As an undergraduate student, I studied chemistry for 3 years. Somewhat like you, I ended up taking an introduction to anthropology course where, again, my whole perspective on the world was flipped inside out and upside down. And so I ended up switching over to anthropology, where I also completed a degree in 3 semesters. Anyway, the similarities I found quite amusing as I was reading your book and as you talk about that. And you write in the book that leaving engineering school was a relief. And so I'm wondering why this was the case for you.
The reason for me leaving engineering school was a relief, I believe I refer to it in my book as a mental breakout. I felt that I was really hemmed in by the very narrow instrumental goals of engineering projects and the engineering education, which didn't leave a whole lot of room for critical thinking or even ethical considerations. So one of the examples I cite in the book is how we were never required in the 1990s to take a course on engineering ethics. And to the extent that it was even mentioned in passing in our classes, it was more to do with the ethics of, abiding by the terms of a contract rather than issues to do with the safety of products or product design that is socially responsible. So those factors never entered into the discussion or into the conversation. And I recognize that a number of engineering schools have gotten much better at doing that sort of thing over the past generation. But clearly in the 1990s at the major land grant university that I went to, which was really kind of producing a sort of cookie cutter education for the engineering students, that was not really up for discussion. And those were the kinds of questions that really fascinated me the most. And so I found myself very unfulfilled in that way as an engineering student. The other thing I should mention is that at the time I didn't really critically think about, but it was the fact that there was such a heavy, it was such a heavily gendered experience. It was the classes, for example, in mechanical engineering were easily 90 to 95% males. It was a very undiverse, a very homogenous kind of student population and faculty population for that matter as well. and to enter into an engineering or into an anthropology class, and to see that there was, you know, probably more females than males in the class, and a lot more diversity in terms of ethnicity and nationality, to me just made the university experience what I had hoped it would be from the beginning. And so to me, that's been also part of that escape, having left engineering. Now, I'll readily admit, I still have a very soft spot in my heart for engineering as a discipline, as a profession. In fact, two of my three siblings are engineers by training, and I think it's a very good fit for them. But at the same time, I had to acknowledge early on that it just wasn't for me.
Sure, sure. And thank you for that. Let's get into the book itself a little bit more. You note in the book's appendix, anthropologist Laura Nader, in reference to her research on legal institutions, posed this question some time ago: how can you study organizations that won't let you in the door? And so I'd like to pose the same question to you. How does one study big data and the Pentagon? What does so-called fieldwork, or the everyday practice of the anthropologist, look like when you're studying weapons laboratories and the Department of the Defense, for example?
I've been thinking about this question for a long time, for more than really for 15 years now. After I did my doctoral research in this farming village in southern Mexico, shortly after the dissertation came out as a book, there was a really fraught political time in the U.S. and that centered largely around the post 9/11 wars that were initiated and led by the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it got me really thinking about the role of the social sciences in these new wars. And I was very shocked to find out around 2006 and 2007 that there was a new program underway that came to be known as the Human Terrain System program. And the main goal was to embed social scientists, anthropologists in particular, within combat units in Iraq and Afghanistan. And my direction, my research interest took a 180 degree turn. And I literally spent more than 10 years after that looking at questions about militarization and the social sciences. And getting actively involved in critiquing such programs. Many of these programs were, I think, a part of a kind of up-and-coming new form of counterinsurgency theory and practice that was underway, largely centered around General David Petraeus and his military officers and military allies. And so it really got me thinking about how can I study this form of militarized social science when it's not easy to get access. I can't just, you know, walk into the Pentagon, for example, and start building rapport with people there. So what are the different tools that I have to be able to do that? And so here I went back to the classic work of Laura Nader, her Up the Anthropologist article from 1969, in which she kind of lays out a pathway, which is essentially about how to be creative ethnographically. And it's really a piece that is focused on how do you do work in bureaucratic institutions that would rather make decisions and keep themselves sort of behind the scenes rather than out in the public. And so I really followed her framework pretty closely. And the first suggestion that I found really important was what she calls documentary analysis, which is essentially finding whatever documents and reports, budget documents that might be publicly accessible or available. And nowadays, with the internet and the capacity to do online research, it's a kind of historic time in that way. And so much of my work has relied on those kinds of official government sources, including contracts, including what are called RDT&E reports, which are basically research, development, and technology reports that the Department of Defense is required to submit to various Pentagon committees, or various congressional committees, I should say, and started exploring that whole somewhat hidden world that's actually publicly accessible, but not always easy to find online. Other sources that I used were the websites and annual reports of major defense contractors. I began finding a number of nonprofit organizations, probably the most important for this book, of which was a group called Tech Inquiry, which specializes in doing research on tech industry contracts that have been awarded by the Pentagon to some of the biggest names in tech, as well as lots of smaller firms as well. And out of this, and this is the second part of to answer your question, apart from documentary analysis, I've had the opportunity, as I've published more and more in the area of militarization and social science, I've had people within the military reach out to me, wanting to tell their story, oftentimes anonymously, but with information that they really want to share and want me to know about and write about. And in those cases, that can be tricky because you never know what kind of a motivation someone has for approaching you out of nowhere. Sometimes they'll use false names and that sort of thing. And as I say in this appendix, part of the trick here, I think, if you want to do this properly, is to treat it as you would any other fieldwork experience, which is put the person at ease, establish that level of trust, allow that person the level of confidentiality he or she wants, even if it's total anonymity. And try to build that relationship so that you have a better sense of what's actually going on and what you can learn from this person. And sometimes it's very clear that that person might have an axe to grind or might have some sort of personal vendetta against someone else. And so I try to use really good judgment when I encounter those sorts of situations. Finally, I've got to say I've cultivated a fairly small number, but I would say really important group of contacts who work within various elements of the military and intelligence community. And it's a very different culture with lots of different expectations, different kinds of linguistic norms. I'll just give one example. I've got one person who's a trusted friend and anthropologist who happens to be working for the military. And the person did me the favor of going through every page of the book and correcting every time I used the word clandestine inappropriately. So within the world of military intelligence agencies, terms that we might, as anthropologists, just sort of take for granted as ordinary terms like clandestine or secretive or secret or what have you, have very specific meanings within those institutions. And because I do hope that many people within the military industrial complex read this book, and I know there are many critics of these new technologies within the military intelligence communities, I really wanted to give them a sense that I understand their culture and that I respect the terminology that they use and am trying to abide by that in as faithful a way as possible. There's one other kind of funny example here, which is that it turns out that within the military, you don't necessarily have to capitalize the word soldier or pilot, but you should always capitalize the word Marine. Regardless of whether you're talking about the Marine Corps or just an individual Marine, always capitalize that. And so that's a kind of linguistic detail that where I think it's really important to be able to understand these institutions and get a sense of what's going from within and within the norms that they follow.
Interesting. Is the capitalization also the case for like Navy SEAL, for example? I wonder, because I've seen that capitalized.
Yes, definitely. Or Green Berets. So I suspect it has something to do with rank and sort of relative importance of one unit over another.
Okay, interesting. And that actually brings us to another aspect of the book that I think our listeners, once they get their hands on a copy, will notice pretty quickly, and I notice as well, which is the writing style. It feels a little bit different. I would say it's not the same as what would otherwise be considered a heavily academic text, where typically you have it's written for other academics, perhaps solely. I'm curious, was this choice of writing style intentional? What were you trying to do there?
I've very deliberately over the last, I would say, 6 to 7 years or so, tried to abandon as much of the heavy academic prose as possible. I came to a realization that I've established myself firmly enough within the discipline to not necessarily need to be have my writing steeped in heavy jargon. I understand the importance of that and recognize the value of it. However, for the kinds of topics that I'm writing about, for me, it's much more important to use language that's very accessible to people that don't have PhDs in anthropology. In fact, to people that are just, ordinary lay readers who are interested about a topic and want to learn about it. And so what I try to do is, sneak in the anthropology in a way that's palatable and understandable to people so that they can recognize the value of what our discipline has to offer, yet at the same time reach a very large group of people. And I've had a wonderful experience working with my editor at University of California Press and having conversations with her about tips that I can use to develop my writing in that way. For me, what anthropology as a discipline has to offer the world is far too important to be masked or hidden behind jargon that only a few dozen anthropology PhDs are going to understand. We're in that really wonderful position of being able to bring to others within our own society lessons that we've learned from other parts of the world, from societies that are oftentimes solving problems in radically different ways than we are, and that have a tremendous creative capacity that we as a society can learn from. And to not share that with others, to me, seems like an incredibly missed opportunity. And so for me, what I've tried to do, as I said, is to really spend lots of time thinking through literally every sentence and every verb that I'm using and every term that might be off-putting to someone because they just don't understand what it means. And it's been very rewarding. And to me, the interesting thing is that I find that this is what publishers are actually hungry for as well. I mean, because, they want these books to get out to a wide audience too, but you can't just do that with marketing. I mean, you have to have something that's going to be appealing to people. And I was able to get this book, what's called front listed in the UC Press catalog, which means that, the publisher does recognize that there's a real potential for a larger cross-disciplinary audience and hopefully lay audience as well. And along with that comes a lot of self-promotion. I mean, you do have to do your part as well. And my old way of thinking was, okay, the book's published, I'm done, I can move on to the next thing. And with my last two books, I realized actually once it's out in press, that's just the first part. Now you've got to follow through and outreach. And in the case of War Virtually, I had an op-ed piece in the LA Times. We're working on other opportunities as well that give a chance to provide a larger potential audience for the book too. Again, I mean, this sounds all, I suppose, very instrumental and non-anthropological, but to me, this is part of what public anthropology should be. And that's the kind of work I think that's involved if you want to do that.
I have to say, I absolutely agree that it's way more than necessary. It's essential to rethink that writing style and write in a way that offers what anthropological analysis might have to offer to other audiences. Absolutely. Getting into the first part of the book, I have to say I quite liked your commentary on the parallels between data, the concept of data, and the concept of a gift, which is the etymological definition of data. Maybe you can draw that out for us a bit. In considering big data and its militarization, I'm curious, how should we define so-called big data? And what's its connection with the concept of the gift?
As I say in the first chapter of the book, data, the word literally means gift if we analyze it historically. Its roots are actually from an ancient Latin word, datum, which means that which is given. The word entered the English language in the mid-1600s as a philosophical term, actually, for things known or assumed to be facts. It had originally nothing to do with numbers, but by the end of the 1800s, in the English language anyway, it did tend to, by that point, have a connotation meaning facts based on numbers and statistics. Fast forward to the 19th century and the computer age, and data began to take on a different meaning entirely, which was basically numerical information that can be stored and transmitted easily by computer. But I think it's important to remember that original connection to the concept of gift when contemplating data and big data today. And I have to give credit to Gillian Tett and some of what she's written. She's an anthropologist who's also editor of the Financial Times newspaper. But she, in one of her columns, pointed out this etymological connection between data and gift and gift giving. And I think the broad point here is that one way of thinking about data, personal data, for example, personal information, which is often what is meant when we talk about big data in the context, for example, of social media or Facebook or what have you. What we're talking about are bits of information about our personal lives, including our relationship, data about when we are born or our ethnicity or religious or political preferences and so on. And so on the one hand, you've got this information. On the other hand, we might think about this as gifts that we offer up to a company like Facebook or Twitter whenever we use their services. And the interesting connection here between gifts and reciprocity and that whole long anthropological tradition stretching back to Mauss and Malinowski and so on, is that I think in the minds of a lot of users of the new digital apps and platforms like Facebook and Twitter, there's a kind of reciprocal exchange going on whereby we give information to these companies with the other understanding that they're going to be providing us with these ostensibly free services. The problem with that is that it's not a free exchange by any means. Of course, as I think your listeners will know, data, our personal data, is monetized all the time by pretty much all of the tech firms. This is what their business models are based on advertising. And I think much of the outrage that's been directed at companies like Facebook and Twitter and others in recent years is a growing awareness on the part of us, the givers of data, that this is not a free exchange and not truly reciprocal, but instead the marketplace has somehow gotten involved somehow. So just for me, I think that's been a useful means of thinking about data in a different way, in a more anthropological way, and also one that helps us understand shifting ideas about big data itself in our society. Now, what's the connection here to the military. What do I mean when I talk about in the subtitle of the book, the militarization of big data? Well, what I mean here is that, and I should back up and say that when I talk about virtual warfare in the book, I'm really talking about four, if you want, new directions in 21st century warfare. The first of these, which we can get into in a bit if you'd like, is autonomous and robotic weapon systems. The second is cyber warfare and cybersecurity and cyber defense. The third, for me, is a whole range of software programs that are collectively known as predictive modeling software. Predictive policing programs are one example of this. The fourth element is what I would refer to as high-tech psyops, high-tech psychological operations, which are really based on the militarization of big data, using data that a company like Cambridge Analytica, for example, can harvest from Facebook and then use for very concerted political purposes to convince individual users of Facebook who have been targeted because of their potential preferences to vote for this candidate or just to not vote at all, or to take this position on Roe versus Wade or that position on gun control. And so there's a chapter of the book in where I explore that more fully. So that, I think, is the key connection between the world of social media and the military use of big data. And I think there's more and more of that happening with each passing month, and not just in the United States. This is in many different countries that this sort of high-tech psyops is happening.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you, yeah, for that. And you know, it's true, when before reading your book, thinking about the relationship between the personal data I give, for example, to social media companies, I had never really thought about that going anywhere else besides sort of in their algorithms for advertising. And you make that link very clear, that our personal data and experience online isn't just going for the ads. There's connections where that feed into other programs, even that are part of the Pentagon and Department of Defense, which perhaps we can talk about a little bit later. Throughout the book, but especially starting in chapter 3, you discuss the relationship exactly between U.S. intelligence agencies, Silicon Valley tech companies, and investment firms. And so I have another question for you, which is, what is a dual-use technology? And if you could define that term, that'd be great. What is the concept, and what does it help us understand about a company like Google, for example? In what sense is the idea of a dual-use technology a misnomer? And in what sense might we consider a company like Google to have an origin myth?
The chapter of my book that you're referring to is, the title is Pentagon West, and it really ties together a lot of the themes throughout the book. One of the underlying currents that I thought was really important to talk about was how we would do well to start thinking about Silicon Valley and the tech industry more generally, not just as something separate from the military-industrial complex, but as an integral part of the military-industrial complex. And also a recognition that this isn't new either, that those connections have been around for a long time, but that we're going through a period of an intensification of that relationship between big tech and big defense. Now, to answer the question, about dual use technologies, this is a concept that has that I really am borrowing here from an anthropologist by the name of David Price, who who's a friend and someone who I've published a number of pieces with over the years. But he has a very, I think, useful idea of dual tech uses of scientific knowledge, which I apply more to technologies in this book. And the idea, dual use means different things depending on the context. But in general, I would say it has to do with the development of a technology, perhaps by a civilian company or a civilian inventor, that can then be adapted and used for the military, for military purposes. So that would be an example of a dual use situation. Let me just give one example, which I touch on briefly in the book. If we think about virtual reality headsets, right? So you've got the Oculus and you've got various other models that are out there. These, as best as I know, were not developed for military purposes. These were developed, I believe, for gaming and then a number of other applications in the civilian world. About 5 years ago, it turns out that Microsoft struck a deal with the U.S. Army to produce more than 100,000 of its virtual reality headsets, which is called the HoloLens, for use by infantry on the ground. And this is probably the largest contract that Microsoft's had for its virtual reality headsets since they started marketing them. I would be surprised if there was a larger single order than this one. So here's a great example, I think, of a dual-use technology that's developed for civilian purposes originally, but then gets used by the military. We can look at things working in the other direction as well. If we think about the internet, in its early stages, was actually a Defense Department project in the late 1960s that was called the ARPANET, which then later on became the modern day internet and is now used primarily for civilian purposes. So this idea of dual use, it's a two-way street. It's not just unidirectional. But for me, it's a really important concept to keep in mind because it sensitizes us to the ease with which technologies or knowledge can cross this border and how something that was never for military use can become militarized or weaponized in some cases. So that, in essence, is what the concept is about. And I think it's also really useful for helping us understand this longstanding connection between the emergence of Silicon Valley as this incredibly important hub of innovation and of economic power and might, and the military-industrial complex as well. Now, to get to the part of your question that has to do with Google, let me talk a little bit about this case. I think that, like many tech companies, it has its own kind of origin story, a sort of mythology about how the company was created and how it grew. But like any myth, like any origin story, it has to be taken with a grain of salt. And it has one has to question, what's the real motivation of this myth and what function is it serving in the society at large? The origin myth of Google goes something like this. In the 1990s, you had a couple of just really brilliant Stanford students that were able to cobble together a number of computers and use the university's basically internet connection to create this dynamic new search engine using you know, this wonderful new algorithm that that the creators developed. And the rest is history, right? That, so the myth is that, you know, by their own determination, grit, and just genius, their immense innovative power, these two renegade Stanford students created one of the most valuable companies on the planet that serves us in so many ways, from Gmail to the search engine that we use on a daily basis. And their company now is even a verb, right? We talk about Googling things, which I guess really means you've made the big time. The fact of the matter is, and the part of the story that's often forgotten or never mentioned, is the fact that the creators of the Google search engine and the founders of the company were in fact financed with taxpayer dollars that came from the U.S. military and intelligence communities, who were interested in the possibility of a kind of worldwide archive of material that could be, it's like the biggest open source treasure in history. And I think the Pentagon understood this when they started pumping money into this project in the early years, because I think they understood it could serve their intelligence gathering purposes in very powerful ways. And so I think that's an important part of the story to keep in mind. Now, we can back up historically, and we can apply the same kind of analysis to Silicon Valley as a whole. So again, whether we're talking about, you know, the development of the original semiconductors in the late 1950s in Mountain View, California, at the heart of Silicon Valley, or whether we're talking about, you know, the experiments that led to the Apple IIe computer and so on out of someone's garage. What is often left out of the picture is that there was Pentagon funding from the very beginning, from the development of those first semiconductors back in the 50s, so that there's always been that connection there, although often in the background. And that's something that I try to highlight. By no means am I the first person to expose this. I mean, there have been a number of historians and investigative journalists that have gone into a lot more depth on this than I have. But as someone working at San Jose State University, which, you know, our logo at the university is powering Silicon Valley. You know, it's like we take great pride in being at the heart of this area. And yet many of my colleagues are either unaware or have forgotten about this history or just don't acknowledge it. And it's, I think, to fully understand the region and to fully understand this ongoing relationship and connection between big tech and big defense, you have to understand that this is part of a longer term historical trajectory that's only now taking up, taking on greater size and more importance than ever. Just one last thought here on this topic. What ultimately convinced me to do this book? I had had the idea in my mind for some time of writing a book on this, but it was a conversation with a former Google chief research scientist. He has a PhD in applied mathematics, brilliant guy. But he actually left the company when he found out that Google executives had signed a multi-million dollar contract to do artificial intelligence analysis on drone footage being basically sent in from Afghanistan. The number of photographs and images that these drones were taking on a daily basis far outstripped the Pentagon's capacity to analyze them. So they wanted to farm it off. And who better to farm it off to than Google? The problem was Google didn't tell its employees. And then a number of leaked emails went to the press, and the so-called Project Maven fiasco hit the headlines for a brief period anyway. And so this chief scientist that I've gotten to know better over the last couple of years quit the company in protest and created a research organization that is doing some fine work now on the connections between Silicon Valley and the Pentagon and intelligence community. But the point is, in one of our exchanges, he said something along these lines when I asked him, you know, what do you think the future holds for the connection between big tech and big defense? What he told me was, and I'm paraphrasing here, it's much worse than you imagine. He said, in my mind, I don't think we're that far from the day that Amazon may just snap up what a major defense contractor, like think Raytheon or Lockheed Martin. And what he told me was, just think of the financial resources that a company like Amazon has, which are so much greater than even the largest military firm. And what would prevent them from doing that if they thought it was in their own best interest to do so? And at that, it's at that point I realized I really need to write a book about this, because this is a really troubling future for me, in which big tech and big defense, these two areas that have so much economic and cultural and political power, not just in our society, but around the world, might pose that kind of a threat for us as a society down the line.
Well, and I'm very glad that you did write the book, because it helps me and our listeners organize some of these trends we hear perhaps in the news and on social media of the relationship between Silicon Valley and, say, the Pentagon. And I wanted to note, you also in the book dive pretty deep into past and current resistance of employees that work at these companies, for example, Google, Amazon, and that your approach, I really appreciate your approach, and it helps us understand the complexity of what might be going on in some of these companies. So perhaps later we can touch on that. But I wanted to pick up on one of the directions you talked about at the beginning of our conversation, which would be predictive analytics and predictive policing, for example. In the latter part of the book, you talk about the seductiveness of predictive analytics. And so I'm wondering, seductive in what sense? And perhaps to answer this, you can describe to us what Aptima is, which is an example of a project that you talk about in the book. And that is, that concerns predictive analytics. It's almost laughable when I was reading about it. And I think we're tempted to laugh off claims of creating software that can predict responses to military actions based off social theory, even anthropological theory, and identity trackers, for example. But why, in your mind, should we take these attempts to create such software seriously?
Predictive modeling software. Let me first try my best to describe what this is. There are different kinds of programs, that some of which are being created by major defense contractors like Lockheed Martin, and many of which are produced by relatively small companies like Aptima, which I spent some time talking about in the book. They're not a household name the way Lockheed Martin or some of the other large firms, defense firms might be, but they're quite specialized in that their featured products are really these predictive modeling programs. What they do in these programs is to use a combination of different forms of data. So some of these might be Twitter feeds that are then analyzed and mined. Some of them might be open source, other forms of open source intelligence that might be harvested from media companies around the world. They might include social media monitoring elements as well, that are able to comb through, Facebook posts and things like that, to try to detect trends that are happening in different parts of the world. The idea here is that if you have enough data sources and you're able to integrate them and analyze them quickly enough, and here's the seduction part, then you can potentially, or hypothetically, I should say, be able to predict where future conflicts are likely to occur. And so the I think that the attractive part of all of this is this kind of sense that you could almost have a sort of computational crystal ball that would allow you to see several weeks or several months into the future to determine the likelihood of an invasion of this country by another country, for example, or an insurgency movement occurring in a certain South Asian country, for example. And I think that's very appealing to military decision makers within the military and intelligence communities because of the, I suppose, the efficiency with which it would allow them to do their intelligence work. And at least if the products actually worked as advertised, it would allow them the kind of lead time they might need to deploy troops if needed, or to begin planning for future scenarios on the ground. The problem with this is that these programs in the current period don't seem to be working really well. So, for example, the Ukraine conflict, it's not as if any of these predictive modeling software programs predicted the invasion of Russian troops in January, February. So, you know, it's in a way, I agree. I mean, and I had a hard time not sort of chuckling through some of these programs as they're described and as they actually work. And yet, I think the troubling part of this for me, and the thing that we should all be thinking about, is that it's very likely that they're going to become more sophisticated, and that they're going to be integrating a lot better data over time, particularly anthropological data that may be more qualitative in nature. And I think this is something that, as anthropologists anyway, we should be thinking through in terms of the ethics of it, and the ethics of doing this kind of work. Now, predictive policing is a little bit different. It does fit under the same general category of predictive modeling software. But predictive policing, which I do spend a number of pages in the book talking about, to me is really interesting because it shows how easily these kinds of technologies can be used domestically here at home. And so there are many cities within the United States that have bought these programs and are making use of them, even though they are rife with problems. Most importantly is that, and I think this has been quite well documented at this point, there's a tendency for these programs to focus their predictions for street crime, for example, in largely black and brown neighborhoods. So you've got, and as I say in the book, it's data in, you know, garbage in, garbage out, to use the phrase. If you've got bad data going into these predictive modeling programs that are biased and that are already reporting a disproportionate number of crimes in those neighborhoods, then the garbage out at the other end is going to be that prediction that that's where more crime is likely to happen, even though the models they're using are really dubious and have been criticized by many experts who understand, you know, the algorithmic processes that are being used in these programs.
Right. Thank you for that. So, of course, we can't cover everything in the book, which really is a very thoroughly researched book that dives deep into the topic of virtual warfare. However, I wanted to ask, are there any arguments or points that you wanted to highlight or a few that we missed in our discussion?
There are so many examples that I give in the book that I think could leave people feeling really powerless as they read it. But that by no means is my intention. In fact, I would say the opposite is my purpose, to really wake people up to the really fast rate at which these technologies are being developed and how there are movements underway to push back against these technologies. So I'll just mention two examples. One I've already alluded to. That is the what I call the resistance movement within the tech industry, which doesn't get as much attention as it should. You have had worker protest movements happening at some of the largest tech companies, including Google. Microsoft workers protested when that virtual reality headset contract was granted to the company by the U.S. military. You had Amazon workers protesting when its recognition, facial recognition technology program was sold to Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers. So you've got, I think the development now, it's really exciting to me that you've got workers that are actually becoming so, I would say, politicized as they see these decisions being made by corporate executives without consultation of workers. And in other industries, that might not be a big deal, but historically, many tech firms have prided themselves on really being employee-focused and sensitive to the needs and opinions of employees. So that is very much a work in progress, I think. But for me, it gives me a lot of optimism about the potential for pushing back against these forces. The other example here, I would say, in terms of reason for optimism, is that I do spend, we haven't talked about it much, but I've got an early chapter in the book in which I look really critically at automated weapon systems, drones in particular. And you do have, I think, more and more people, and this is a global movement actually, that are really critical of the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, not just by the US, but by other countries as well. And the frightening prospect of these things being given full autonomy so that they're essentially making the decision to kill on their own with no input from humans. So along that vein, you've got groups like the what's called the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, which is an alliance of numerous NGOs around the world that includes the International Committee Against Robot Arms and Amnesty International. Human Rights Watch is a part of that coalition as well. So those movements are just picking up, I think, more and more support as time goes on and as more and more countries adopt these forms of unmanned weapon systems that can potentially be made into autonomous, fully autonomous weapon systems. So for these reasons, you know, I try to end the book in such a way that by presenting alternatives for people that feel that they want to sort of join in pushing back against the development and deployment of these new technologies.
Absolutely. Well, I think I've taken up enough of your time today. But before you go, can you tell us a bit about what you might be working on now?
Sure. One of the things, let me just back up and say that part of the reason I was attracted to anthropology is just the shockingly broad number of things you can study within even a subfield like cultural anthropology. You can do a project on religion or agriculture or science and technology. You can study health and wellness. You can study sexual practices around the world. You name it, art, music. To me, as someone that's always, I think, had a pretty eclectic range of interests, that was a huge draw, which anthropology allowed. And so we've talked about a number of quite different research projects that I've undertaken over the past 25 years, ranging from the fields of southern Mexico to Pentagon, autonomous weapon systems. And anthropology has room for all of that. My next project, to get to your question, is, I guess you might say, totally unrelated to anything I've done before as an anthropologist. And it's actually a manuscript that I'm working on that is focusing on the working lives of mariachi musicians in the San Francisco Bay Area. And one of my side jobs, one of my hustles about 20 years ago, was playing with a group that we were the house band at a nice seafood restaurant in the Mission District of San Francisco, which at the time was largely, Latino and continues to be. There were quite a few adventures that we had. The guys in the band, there were two of us that were U.S. citizens. The rest were undocumented folks from Western and Central Mexico. And it gave an incredible window into the different ways of life across the Bay Area. The book is, I'm again challenging myself with the writing style because I'm reading everything from Hunter S. Thompson to Anthony Bourdain to try to get ideas on the writing style, because I'm really aiming for something that's quite novelistic in terms of its approach, but that also has that anthropological insight into, for example, what it's like to play as an undocumented mariachi musician at a Silicon Valley firm's Cinco de Mayo party in the afternoon. And then the next day, play a garage party on the east side of Oakland for 100 people, all of whom are undocumented, so that it would be an ethnography, in essence, about the Bay Area in a way, but seen through the eyes of a working mariachi group and also introducing readers into the ordinary working lives of these people that were my friends for a good number of years. So that's the idea. I'm, working on it this summer and just having a lot of fun with it, but at the same time trying to, I never took field notes on any of this, so I'm having to reconstruct a lot of this just from memory.
Okay, well, that's great to hear. I will definitely be looking forward to reading that work. Just as a final plug, I wanted to say that this book, or virtually, does really make connections that I had not come across yet, which I really appreciated. I have to say that I learned quite a bit, and I also appreciated how succinct you are in your writing. And I would highly encourage our listeners to get their hands on a copy of the book if they can. Thank you very much, Roberto, for joining me today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure, and I really appreciate the chance to share this book with your listeners.